Welcome to the 32nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that's almost as dependable as the West Indies top order.
But if there's one good thing about having an unreliable top order, it is the fact that it makes for some very, very exciting cricket. I spent most of the last week over in Finland, actually. And I was checking cricket info occasionally, and you just come back and it would just look like a completely different game. And mostly that was actually due to the fact that the West Indies
You're
middle
order... You're thanking Kirk Edwards here for his ability to...
Yeah, exactly. But the West Indies middle order were absolutely remarkable in turning round what seemed to be lost
and
causes.
So we're used to Shiv being the hero, but what for me was so exciting about this is we had a bit of a new hero in Marlon Samuels. Interesting story here. Age 19, he was really seen as a prodigy. The Viv Richards comparisons came very early on. And if you'd asked someone about Samuels a year ago, he appeared to have been a kind of a, like a what-if story. He had all the talent, never really fulfilled it. Very middling test career, you know, average in the 20s. All of this compounded by a ban for involvement with match fixing that lasted 2 years. Age 31 now, his career looked to be kind of had almost passed him by. You know, what a series he's had. 310 runs from four innings. He's outscored anyone in the series. His 100 at Trent Bridge in particular was masterful. I mean, his side was an absolute tatters. The game looked gone. I think they were 136 for six. Sammy obviously played brilliant, but Samuels was brilliant. He was self-controlled. You know, for a player that's been at the IPL, he showed no problem in adapting his mentality to the test format.
It's interesting. You make the comparison with Chanderpaul. And actually, when you're batting in a middle order alongside Chanderpaul, it must actually be quite difficult to be able to motivate yourself to kind of be that Chanderpaul-esque figure simply because Chanderpaul is there. And what's been, for me, most remarkable about him is the way that he has kind of taken often the whole situation on his own shoulders and dug the team out almost single-handed.
I wonder what influence Chanderpaul maybe had on him, you know, batting together at Lords. I mean, that was another fantastic partnership that, again, I mean, he's been responsible both at Trent Bridge and Lords for creating contests out of games that had gone. And what a player he is when he goes on the attack as well. You know, we saw him in a lot of patience, but, I mean, glorious driving the ball. And the way he sort of stood up, against a really impressive and a really quite fearsome England attack, a particularly angry Jimmy Anderson. He's certainly been my sort of the highlight of the past sort of fortnight.
On the other side of the fence, I've been impressed once again. I'm a big fan of Tim Bresnan. It's something I know we don't entirely agree on. But I thought at Trent Bridge, Bresnan showed exactly why it is that he is so vital a linchpin to this England attack. And I think he is a bit of a linchpin, actually, because you have Anderson and Broad, who are in a sense, it sounds like a ludicrous thing to say in the case of Anderson particularly, but in a sense, one-dimensional bowlers. In the sense that Broad hits the pitch very hard, Anderson is a proper, quick swing bowler. Bresnan is very, very adaptable as a bowler. I saw him last summer at Trent Bridge roughing up Yuvraj against the Indians, and then at Trent Bridge this time, the way that he bowled just back of a length, really that kind of nagging line.
I mean, it feels harsh, in my opinion, to have a go at him. I'm not really having a go at him. You know, he's just had a very successful test match again, 8 wickets. And there were several people I know who, and I was sort of in agreement with that, who felt maybe try someone new for the second test because he didn't seem overly impressive at Lords. My feeling is just whether he's had a good series against the West Indies, whether perhaps he might struggle to trouble the best South African batsman. But I'd accept that actually these questions have been raised about him before and he has answered them pretty
emphatically. Particularly against the Indians last summer, right?
Yeah, against the Indians. And actually, bowled well in the Ashes as well.
13 matches, 13 wins. You can't argue
very difficult to
you would be
that.
Cursing yourself to drop him, I think, is the point there.
Well, I mean, another Yorkshireman who has, well, certainly been having a much poorer time of things. This week, Adil Rashid was dropped, which I think is really, really sad, actually. We all have loved the idea for a while, I think, of England developing a genuinely world-class leg spinner. And a couple of years ago, Rashid had everything. He's had some extraordinarily successful seasons in county cricket. You know, 60 wickets a season in 2008, as a youngster. And an incredible...
With a remarkable batting average.
And a remarkable batting average, you know, a genuine all-rounder. He had a very difficult year last year when Yorkshire went down, and he's been dropped this week, and Geoffrey Boycott was very damning of him, said, "It's your fault, you haven't progressed." He's 24 and he's clearly at a real crossroad in his career. My concern is whether this approach, this kind of, it's wrong to call it bullying, but this kind of sort of harsh, strong-handed approach may backfire here, and that there's a young talent here that still needs to be nurtured, and that perhaps this attitude. Yorkshire may be missing a trick here, actually.
It's interesting because we have all these stereotypes about Yorkshire cricket, most of them summed up by Geoffrey Boycott, of it being an incredibly sort of harsh cricketing, sort of sink or swim cricketing community. And obviously a lot of fantastic players have come out of it. But I suppose one of the problems is that from the outside, it's so difficult to know when you just hear about these things through the press, exactly what it is that's going on behind the scenes, who it is that's sort of pushing the process forward, whether it is Rashid who's, you know, just accepting to...
Well, this is it. I mean, what we can't... You're quite right in that what we can't see is there a genuine lack of application on his part? You know, has Rashid failed to get places? I think one thing we do need to accept, though, is that it is a really difficult craft, and, you know, young lacemen are inevitably going to struggle at times. But I think he certainly faces a pivotal season now.
Another interesting career change over the last few days has been that of Kevin Peterson, who announced, I think today actually, that he is giving up playing international one day and 2020 cricket, which is, again, it's one of those things that I don't think one... from the outside, you can really know what to make of it in the sense of whether, you know, was he pushed by the ECB? Did he know he was going to be dropped and therefore he, you know, decided to
retire? Well, it's interesting. There hasn't been a clear sort of apportioning of blame here, has there, within the media? I've seen people going after both, actually. People sort of damning Peterson and damning the ECB. Yep.
But I think it's interesting. It's an interesting power shift that the bodies in cricket, the ECB say, traditionally were the people who were responsible for managing a player's workload. But now the fact that a player feels that they have to do that for themselves, I think is a very interesting shift. And I think it has quite considerable implications for the way that say the ECB is using their players, kind of exploiting their players as opposed to looking after.
It's an interesting test, I guess, of Andy Flower's regime in that I imagine there must have been a conversation here where Peterson said, look, I'll play 2020, but I won't play one of those. I mean, I am suggesting that. I don't know with certainty, but I'd imagine that conversation took place. And what's interesting is that Flower and co. seem to have stood firm and say, no, this is our rule.
Well, there is this rule, isn't there, that you can... you have to play both. You have to be available for both one day and 2020 cricket. You can't say you want to play one or other. You can make yourself unavailable for both or available for both. And I mean, Strauss is an interesting example who only plays in one. He plays in one day, but not in 2020s. And of course, the England powers that be would say that was because he's, you know, not as good as a 2020 player. But you imagine it's probably because they just want to rest him for 2020s.
I think we can all agree that it would be very disappointing if, as we now assume, KP won't go to the 2020 World Cup this winter. From the archives, and this week Toby's taking us back to 1930. We're in Georgetown and it's the West Indies' first ever Test victory against England.
It's quite interesting as the West Indies come over to tour England and we think back at the history of the West Indies and you think of the great Test side, one day sides even of the 70s and 80s and the some of the glory days and some of the poorer days before that. It's quite interesting to go back to when the West Indies were completely new kids on the block, completely unknown quantity. They made their Test debut, as it were, in 1928, or was it 1929?
1928.
When they came over to England and they played at Lord's. And then the following year, the winter of 1929, England went back to the West Indies and played a tour there. And this was a huge event, this tour, mostly because cricket in the West Indies was and still is to a large extent hugely laden with political and racial connotations. It was a game that, prior to the West Indies becoming a Test nation in inverted commas, and because of course they are just, well, they are a collection of nations, it was a game that was played mostly by white people and was certainly dominated, was governed by white people. Usually the way that clubs were set up is that basically each club had a group of professionals who were the local black people, and they would mostly be the groundsmen and also do the hard work, be the bowlers.
So in a sense, I mean, cricket and the MCC as a whole can come across as relatively forward thinking here, that in the 1920s, at a time when you know, segregation was in full flow. I mean, or not quite the right way of putting it, in the US, segregation was still in place. They were willing to go and tour against a black side.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's one of these topics where the history of it is just so tangled, depending on who you listen to. Actually, there's a big argument that that the MCC's hand was kind of forced in going to tour in the West Indies, and actually they got to a stage where they really, really couldn't, simply because the West Indies had, or the native players of the West Indies had become so... sorry, that's my phone buzzing happily away in the background. We'll let that buzz. Had become so good that the MCC, if they said, no, we're not going to come and play, they would have looked scared of losing.
Mm.
And actually, this of course, is what happened in this tour. The first two tests of the tour were fairly uneventful, actually. They were characterised by the fact that neither side... They were remarkably well-balanced, actually. When you think of, you know, when Sri Lanka first came into the test arena, when Bangladesh still in the...
I was going to say, in terms of the timing, it's extraordinary how quickly this West Indies side was competitive.
2 years later, yeah.
I mean, I guess they've had to wait for a while, so there's players here who've got experience. And I guess also you could perhaps say that whereas teams like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh have come into an environment where they're against very, very professional sides, perhaps this England side wasn't. I mean, actually, that as a separate point. I mean, was this England 11 a strong 11? I mean, did England send the best they could send?
I mean, you look, it wasn't the very best they could have sent, but there are some pretty significant players there. So the keeper is Les Ames, one of the finest keeper batsmen ever to have played the game. His biography calls him the finest ever. I don't know whether we'd entirely agree with that. Wilfred Rhodes, the great off spinner. Bill Vose, who was Harold Larwood's partner in crime at Nottingham. Patsy Hendren, very fine batsman. So, and George Gamm as well, who was another very good batsman. It certainly was a good England. It was a side that England called their own. I think. And what's remarkable about the first test in the series is the fact that they're not characterised by what you often get with sort of early nations at the beginning of their fledgling test careers, which is calamitous batting collapses followed by amazing tail-end thrashing that brings a massive turnaround. They were just sort of slow and steady test matches, but actually shows the extent to which the West Indies really, really could play cricket. And then in this third test, which is in February 1930, basically you have Clifford Roach, who had been there since the beginning, even though it had only been 2 years earlier. But he'd also scored the first ever test century for the West Indies, which was in the first test of this series. He comes out and scores an absolutely remarkable 209 in just 295 minutes, which is actually very, very quick on uncovered pitches, scoring 22 fours along the way. And actually,
why is Roach's name? I mean, you look at some of these names here. We've got Headley, you know, the Black Bradman. We've got Constantine here. Guys who've become almost like legends, almost like founding fathers of the West Indian game. Why is Roach's name perhaps, you know, why is he not often mentioned amongst that?
Simply because he didn't play all that much Test cricket. And actually, I don't know off the top of my head trust you to ask a question, you know, ask the tricky question. I don't know why that was. Interestingly, someone like George Headley, known as the Black Bradman, and one of the reasons why he became so infamous, and one of the reasons why Test cricket in the West Indies became so infamous so quickly, was simply because there was so much sort of national identity that was built around the cricket side. And George Headley was this figure who everyone championed. You know, he was the black man's Bradman. You know, so if the white races could say we have Bradman that shows our superiority, this is the West Indies actually saying, and yes, the black races have, you know, people of equal stature to rival yours. And so you get these players who are built up to an incredible extent. And in fact, Roach scores a double 100, and George Headley scores 100, and together they bring the West Indies to a total of 471 in the first innings. This isn't a particularly thrilling game of cricket. England collapse somewhat to 145 all out, so they're about they're about 300, more than 300 behind on the first innings. The West Indies go in and have another solid innings. Headley scores another century, and England end up chasing an improbable 617 to win, which on an uncovered pitch, even in a
although they
test,
come very close to saving
they,
the game.
They do come very, very close to saving the game eventually, in something like only 3/4 of an hour.
To the interview, and this week we spoke to Rohan Mascarenhas from the excellent Ducking Beamers blog. I mean, I just wondered, as a sort of starting point, kind of what your thoughts were on the health of the cricket blogosphere generally. I mean, do you think it's in sort of good condition? Do you find yourself reading a lot of good stuff?
I think actually over the last maybe 6 months or a year, it's sort of changed because Twitter has really taken over to a large extent. I think when I started blogging about 4 or 5 years ago now, it was in a much stronger place.
Yeah.
And now I think that if you really want the sort of community and quick reactions, but still insightful comments, you could find them on Twitter during a big match. That said, there are still some bloggers who are going strong. And I think it's sort of been like, whereas blogs before were a quick place to find, commentary, now it's become a place more where you have to have a singular voice. You have to have a little bit more insight in what you're writing. So it's sort of changed where Twitter is the place for, you know, quick reactions, and the blog.
Sure. And I know you use Twitter as well. And I mean, it's something I've been trying to get into as well. I mean, do you feel it effective as a medium? Because it does clearly do something very different to the blogs. But do you feel it's effective in some way where you can get kind of genuine insight? Or is it something, I mean, is it just something very, very different to what the blogs were trying to do?
It's a good place to sort of do a quick survey of what other people are thinking. And so there are a couple of things where, one, you just get to see what other cricket fans are thinking minute to minute during a cricket match. And that's actually quite exciting, especially if you're in America and you don't have access to that many cricket
Sure.
fans as I do. But then I find it most useful because there are moments where disagreements pop up. And I think that Twitter itself isn't a good place to adjudicate these disagreements. Like, I actually think Twitter is a very difficult place to have an actual discussion because you're limited to 140 characters, right?
Right.
But
yeah.
It's a good place to then sort of, once the match is over and you sign out of Twitter, it's a good place to get some ideas for a longer piece on the blog. And I've done that a couple of times where I remember the whole Ian Bell run-out controversy
sure.
from last year, right, where there were all these tweets just flying. And I thought, well, you know, we need to talk about this at more length. And I went to blog about it, and as did others. And so I think it's a good place where it starts on Twitter and it finishes on your blog.
Sure, because I think, well, one thing I'd certainly agree with you on, it does, you find yourself in some interactions that would have just been impossible before Twitter. I mean, you find yourself discussing, I actually first really got into it with the Australia India series, and I found myself getting some really interesting insight from, you know, fans who were, by virtue of being in Australia at the time, able to sort of get a lot more out of it. I just wondered whether you thought there's occasionally a bit of a problem perhaps with there can be a sort of crowd mentality to it, I wonder, on certain topics where you find yourself watching a game and a lot of what Twitter is full is less insight than often just kind of almost gossip. Kind of, there's a lot of, I mean, particularly that sort of, that India-Pakistan tension always sort of seems to rear its head into some form or another.
You're going to find this, though, on the internet in general. I mean, I remember, because I used to watch a lot of cricket on these illegal cricket streams on websites, and they always had like a chat room attached to it for some reason. And these were the most nauseating venues and forums. I think with Twitter, though, you get better at it, just as with anything, with reading or blogging, you get better at figuring out whom you like and who makes proper comments that you know, generally prefer to read than others. There are many times when I, you know, the same thought is expressed about 100,000 times. But
Have you found much value in following players themselves? I mean, have you found that engaging?
No, actually, I don't. I really don't see a point in it. You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe I should after the whole Kevin Peterson, Nick Knight controversy. Yeah. But I just don't see a point in it. And, you know, it's the same thing I feel actually when players talk about how they play after, you know, in post-match press conferences. I always find that to be some of the most embarrassing moments.
Yeah.
Cricket fan, right? Because you realize that these people who are so artful and beautiful when they play are not nearly as articulate and engaged when they actually have to speak. There are some exceptions, right? Like, I listen, if Rahul Dravid had a Twitter, I would do that.
Not really his style, is it?
Right, exactly. And that's exactly the point, right? Rahul Dravid doesn't have a Twitter account precisely because his insight can't be bottled into 140 characters. So I really don't follow players all that much, and I don't really understand what the appeal is. Yeah, I'm sorry to say.
No, I thought it was interesting when Andrew Strauss came out after the Kevin Peterson thing and actually just said, well, I don't tweet because I think it'd be very boring, basically. And I thought it was very honest and quite fair.
Also, to a certain extent, like, I'm not really interested in personal lives of cricketers. And I feel like I might be wrong on this, but I feel like that does take up a lot of what they tweet about. And, you know, that's not why I follow.
Why you follow the game, sure.
Yeah, it's not why I follow the game.
I just wonder, going back to the point you made about blogs, because I thought it was really interesting you said that the sort of blogosphere has had to kind of refine itself and the individual blogs have had to really establish what it is they do. I wonder if, in your personal case, I mean, have you had that process with Ducking Beamers? Have you had to rethink, this is what I enjoy doing, this is what I'm good at? I mean, have you sort of come round to a sense of, have you developed a real sense of what your blog is specifically about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually over the last year, I've become increasingly better at defining my voice and what I'm interested in. So what I'll try and do is like ask a big sort of question, like something like, how have I changed as a cricket fan? Or is science taking over the game? And then I'll try and answer it. Whereas before, I think I was reacting much more to day-to-day events, you know, or I would be discussing selection choices, or I would be, you know, I think those are much more interesting. So I've become more and more involved and interested, rather, in a couple of big themes. And, you know, one of them is, how do fans experience the game? How do they, like, perceive the game? How do they enjoy the game? And then the other is this question of modernity and how it relates to cricket. You know, and so these are big questions, and that's what's motivating me right now.
And it's interesting that you bring up, because I really enjoyed actually the article, how you felt sort of being a cricket fan changed over time. I'd really like to come back to that in just half a sec. I think you've really spotted something quite interesting when you say, well, previously you look to follow day-to-day events. And I think it's experience we've certainly had on the podcast and an experience I think I've seen with quite a few bloggers, that you realize that actually it's almost futile to kind of compete with Crick Info on day-to-day coverage stuff. And I certainly agree with you that what I enjoy particularly on your blog is that sort of that more philosophical side of it. I just wonder then, could we go maybe think a bit about that article then, this How Have I Changed as a Cricket Fan? Because what I really enjoyed was this focus on saying that actually you've moved from a stage that you followed a team, really, your concern was the national team, to following the individual players. And I got the impression, I think if I'm right, that you felt that was overwhelmingly a positive change.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a positive change, because it does get a little boring after a while. And it's also, you know, quite an emotional investment.
Yeah, sure.
And I just think that there's so much more in the game than whether or not your team is winning. And I think it does take a certain amount of maturity and time to come to appreciate, you know, the finer aspects of the game. And you know, we are right now, there was another blog that I posted about whether or not the game is getting better now, because television is involved and people are learning more about the techniques. And I just feel like, you know, watching Dale Steyn right now, or even Kevin Peterson, I mean, these are players at the top of their games, and there's something beautiful in appreciating that. So I just think it's so much better than just when I was a teenager, did India win? Did India beat Pakistan? How big, but, you know, did India beat Australia? it's just a much better place.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, I find it really interesting. I find myself watching the England West Indies series, and even as an England fan, I found myself hugely enjoying watching Marlon Samuels sort of discover form. And I think it's something that maybe cricket has that a lot of sports struggle to have, actually. You know, I think a lot of sports struggle to go beyond that sort of team affiliation. But do you think, I mean, I found it very interesting because the blog post seemed to connect it to age, if I'm right, that you suggested that you felt you'd grown up and your attitude had changed.
Right.
But it seems to me that still overwhelmingly, I look at the vast majority of cricket fans, and I think that nationalistic element is still really, really key. I mean, would you say within India as well that's still, you know, particularly very strong? I mean, could you envisage a scenario where a lot of Indian cricket fans would take pleasure, for example, in watching an excellent side play against them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's tough. I actually think that it's becoming smaller and smaller now. This is my own personal judgment call, sure. And I imagine a bunch of Indian bloggers are going to excoriate me for saying this. But I think that basically for a lot of people, the pleasure is in seeing India win. And if India wins in a close match, that pleasure is even greater. But at the end of the day, I think India really has to win for a large part of the joy to be there. Now, I don't know whether this was always the case. I mean, there was this writer, Asis Nandi, whom I write about a lot. He's this Indian academic. And he used to say, you know, back in the day in the 60s and 70s, when the West Indies would come to India, you know, Indian fans, they had a place for what the West Indies were supposed to be. Like, they were like the necessary enemy. Like, it's sort of like a mythical figure almost, where you understand that they're the enemy, but they're playing a crucial role in the drama. And so you respected them even though they were the enemy. And I don't know whether that exists anymore, you know. I'm not saying that people don't respect other players. I'm just saying that right now the joy is primarily in, you know, Is my side win.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I still love about the game is the fact that, you know, an opposition player will score 100 and, you know, someone like Marlon Samuels the other week, you know, gets a standing ovation at Trent Bridge. And I do think that's very special. But I find that thesis of yours just extremely interesting. But I guess my curiosity really was whether you felt a large number of fans could sort of, I would like to think a large number of fans could be drawn towards it. Moving on, I guess, from the sort of beauty of cricket, yeah, to the IPL, which I've read, you know, a lot of you writing about with, sort of, with interest. I'm curious, I guess, because I come from, I guess, what is a pretty standard sort of English perspective on it, whereby we've been pretty sceptical of it from day one. I have to say I've watched more of this year's IPL than I have previously, and I've enjoyed a lot of it. I just wondered if your, not objections, but your concerns about it are things that you feel can be addressed, or whether you feel that there's something just fundamentally wrong with the whole thing?
No, I actually come around a lot. This is what I was worried that would happen to me when IPL first started, and it's happened, which is I've gone from all-out opposition to IPL in the first season to now IPL 5, I thought was actually not that bad. Actually, it was pretty great to watch some of the matches, and now I've come to accept it. The worries I have are with the way it's packaged. I think there's just way too much marketing going on with it. And this is, I guess this is sort of like a standard cliche that we make in this, in our, you know, capitalistic consumerist society. And as a result, this cliche gets dismissed as nothing more than, you know, old hat. But I think it's, when you watch the IPL, I really wish they would just focus on the cricket, because it's not all that bad,
yeah,
for what it is. But instead, you get, you know, exposed to two strategic timeouts. You get exposed to interviews with people you don't care about. You get exposed to shots of cheerleaders that, I just don't see what they're adding to the game.
No.
Then you sit through, you know, stadium commentary that's just ludicrous and dumb. You know, Danny Morrison is a famous example.
Yeah.
And so that's my major concern right now. Though there was just this news report now that New Zealand is scheduled to play England next year, and they've scheduled it in such a way that many New Zealand players are not going to be able to show up for a test match against England. They're going to have to choose. And this was the same dilemma that many West Indians faced. That's something
Australia that series, yeah.
I don't know how they're going to deal with that, because I don't see a a good cricket world that is just composed of India, Australia, England, and South Africa. I think that you really do need, you know, the rest of the teams to be up there in terms of quality and talent. And I worry that the major thing that the IPL is going to give them is just to suck away talent and act as a brain drain.
Well, I think it's been fascinating because I think a lot of people share that view. I mean, the sympathy the West Indies have had since they've come to England, I found really interesting. So many people desperate for them to do well because, as you've said, there is a real fear that the way the game's going, you're almost talking about, you know, four powerhouse teams and then the rest. But I think you've got, I mean... Do you see any way that that balance can sort of be restored? Because, I mean, that drain away from New Zealand, but also that drain away from the West Indies, you know, players like Sunil Narine, who is a bit of a travesty that he hasn't been involved at all. I mean, he's now going to play, likely to play in this third test. But.
Yeah, I mean, they're just going to have to, I think eventually they're going to do what everyone says they have to do, which is to create a window for the IPL. And, I mean, I don't know how the English are going to take that, right? Because it comes right in the middle of their own season. But so if they do that, the biggest worry for me is the BCCI and how much cricket is skewing towards the BCCI. And there are a couple of Indian bloggers who sort of don't like how I react to the BCCI. But I guess here's the bigger question, right? Like, we've been talking for about 5 years now, maybe a bit longer, about the rise of India. And I think we in cricket, we are the first really to be exposed to what it means to see the Indian market at work.
Sure.
Because in a lot of other sectors, the Indian market, it hasn't yet matured. And so we are now facing a situation where the Indian consumer can largely dictate to the rest of the world, you know, their personal preferences. And it's a question of how it's going to go, because on the other hand, you have to admire the commitment and passion that Indian cricket fans bring to the game. You have to also admire the money, quite frankly. But on the other hand, you have to worry about who's running the BCCI, who's, you know, is there enough respect for the test game? So this is really a good test case. It's a window into a larger question, which is how is the rise of India going to affect the world? And we in cricket are the first to experience this.
You lead me on really well to the sort of question I was quite keen to conclude on, which is that if I put you in the wonderful position of running world cricket, if I gave you total power over the game, I mean, where would you start? And what do you think would be the most valuable reform that anyone could carry out to the game sort of at the present moment?
Well, one thing that I'm intrigued by, I'm not sure whether it's going to, you know, let's just step back and say, first, I would just love to see, you know, 9 competitive teams.
Sure.
And I don't know whether, if I could run world cricket, I really don't know what I'd have to do to get that happening. I mean, because there are so many problems. There are structural problems in New Zealand and West Indies that I'm not sure are fully tied to the IPL. The West Indies in particular. I mean, the governance over there is insane. So if I had a magic finger and a magic wand and I could make those teams competitive, I would. But I am most intrigued right now by Gideon Hayes' suggestion that we have it all wrong when it comes to the ODI format. I don't know whether you've heard about his proposed model, which is to stop. He wants to make ODIs more like tests. So he's saying stop fiddling around with the rules, which they just did again by saying, you know, you can have 2 bouncers in an over and you can have 4 fielders in within the 15 over, you know, stop changing these rules and instead just say ODI should be 50 over test matches. And I think that's really interesting. And I would want to see that because I don't think the ODI game is done just yet. And so if I had one thing where I could focus, I'd say, let's give that a shot where there are no over restrictions on bowlers. There are no fielding restrictions. You have 50 overs in which to score a game, in which to score your innings, and then the other side has 50 overs in which they can beat that score. I think that would be really interesting.
So to the book review, and this episode we are looking at a book from 1999 which won the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award. It's Sir Derek Burley's A Social History of English Cricket.
This book is extraordinarily ambitious. It seeks to tell cricket's story right from its foundation through to Burley's present day. And it seeks to do more than just tell the story of cricket, but relate that story to changes in society and kind of make the case that what cricket is has always been very strongly determined by where it fits in the grander scheme of things. Going back to the start, Burley makes an incredibly compelling case, one that we've seen before actually on this podcast, really connected with Mike Marcuse and his ideas around the intimate relationship of cricket and gambling. The idea being put forward is actually that it's ridiculous to see gambling as something that followed cricket. Gambling drove cricket. It led people to invest substantially in it. It led to teams to be arranged. It led to games to be organised. It was actually a driving force. And it's brilliantly documented. I mean, the research done for this book is unbelievably thorough. And actually, almost too thorough at times.
It is almost. It's not an easy reader. And I think we both left ourselves probably a little bit too little time to read it. You need a good few weeks, and you need quite a lot of digesting time. It's not the kind of thing you can curl up in bed with.
But you're making it sound like a sort of particularly difficult meal.
Well, it is a pretty stodgy repast. one of the great things about it is it's so well researched, and there's just so much information in it, and there are so many little sort of anecdotes and little tidbits that you would never ordinarily come across. There's this great quotation from Wisden in about 1910, which says, "Cricket does not stand need of alteration. It must not be tampered with to please people who think that it can have the concentrated excitement of an hour and a half's football," which is a little
quite
bit
prophetic.
Prescient. It is a little bit prophetic. And it's quite, you just stumble all the time on these little anecdotes.
And you get the impression that Burley has a love for the game, but he also has a desire to kind of strip the game back to its kind of essentials. This is what cricket was at this particular period in time. And you particularly felt you were interested in kind of the case he made for what cricket was in the 30s, you know, the way that what cricket became changed quite substantially.
There's a very interesting argument he makes about the way in which, so Andy, as you said, he talks about the beginnings of cricket being very much tied up with the sort of the real fabric of what moved society, which was in one instance gambling. And actually, he makes the case that in the 30s, there's a really seismic shift in the way that cricket relates to society. And actually, cricket becomes then an escape from society. It doesn't become so much bound up with the fabric of society. And it's then that you actually get this idea of, I mean, I know the quotation is from before the First World War, but of play up and play the game, that kind of idea of cricket becoming a guardian example of the kind of morals that are lost in day-to-day society, which I thought was really interesting idea.
I mean, and interestingly, going right through to what Burley thought of cricket in his sort of present day in the 90s, his outlook was really quite depressing. He felt the game was sort of out of sync with modern society. He particularly looked at the way the tabloid press treated the national team kind of with scorn, with disdain almost. You know, he really struggled to see how the county game was going to survive. And in a weird way, I quite enjoyed reading this sort of 10, 12 years on, because I felt, well, actually, cricket's evolved. You know, cricket has dealt with a lot of the challenges. I mean, the obvious example being the fact that we have a national side that is no longer a joke, you know.
And Phil Tufnell has become Graham Swan.
Indeed. And I think, it's an interesting kind of benefit of hindsight thing. As a sort of style of book, it is really interesting, because I think we both, as I said, both found it quite challenging to read, which is not to say that Burley writes badly. He writes brilliantly, I think, often. He writes really well. But I think it's interesting that what, in a way, a lot of us as fans of cricket writing enjoy often tend to be the more kind of the anecdotes, the kind of stories of games and stuff, that's easier to read. This is an altogether more kind of robust and more academic affair.
It is, and at the same time, you get a very interesting balance between anecdotes which are purely cricketing and their relationship with things that we would think of as being purely, in inverted commas, historical. So, for instance, his depiction of the relationship between the Whigs and the Tories, and how relationships towards land and the relationships of aristocracy and land actually really changes the game and the way that the game is played, say, at schools in the 19th century is really interesting. And it's quite bold, actually, to have someone coming from the perspective. We talked earlier in this podcast about the West Indies and how about a lot of people who wrote West Indian cricket created a relationship between West Indies political history and West Indian cricket, because it created a very strong narrative that way. What's very interesting about Burley is he is fairly unique in actually being a proper, in inverted commas, historian and a proper cricketing historian, because being a cricketing historian doesn't often mean that you're a historian as well.
Mm. And he's certainly created something that is quite unique, and whether you find sort of everything that's there, you may disagree with much of it, it'll certainly cast large parts of the game in a kind of new light. To the debate, and in the week that Jimmy Anderson rather lost the plot at Trent Bridge, we ask whether a cricketer has any right to lose his temper on the field of play.
Cricketers, well, proper cricketers, test cricketers, wear white. And there's a reason for that. The angelic purity of the test cricketer and the test cricketing arena is incredibly important, because what you have here is you have a relationship between people which is based on respect, and it's based on the opposition not of personalities, not of egos, but of skills. And one of the things that is a considerable argument against the bringing of personal emotion or large and outward personal emotion onto any sporting field is a lot of the reactions that you get in football matches, and a lot of the anger that you get there. And that's not to say that one should never feel anger on a pitch, but actually to allow to have a consensus and a code that allows it to be brought out into the open and to be used effectively, aggressively, is, I think, a very bad thing for the game per se. I think it's a very bad thing for, as an example, I mean, and it sounds incredibly trite to say it, but I think it's actually very true. But I think more than anything, it's actually, it's self-defeating to get outwardly angry on a cricket, because you've kind of lost. When Jimmy Anderson was getting angry with Samuels, it was because he couldn't get him out. It was because he found himself in a situation that he didn't know how to deal with in any other way.
And Samuels did make the point, he said he knew lots of batsmen who could sort of talk and banter while they were playing, but he knew very few bowlers who were able to sustain the same thing. I mean, my issue here is that actually cricket, while I accept the fact that I'm proud of the fact to follow a sport that has an integrity in terms of on-field conduct that, for example, a lot of sports, like, for example, football, has lost, I do also think that cricket is a form of entertainment, and it is a form of drama, and it is a form of theatre, and you're dealing with human beings, and even protagonists. And Jimmy Anderson was his tantrum, and I keep going back to this example, it was kind of compelling to watch. You had someone who you're looking literally absolute indignation.
That's because you're talking absolute rubbish, because I absolutely agree that there is something very compelling about watching human emotion. But there are a lot of places you can watch human emotion. The point about cricket is that the drama of it is inherent in the battle between a bat and a ball. It shouldn't involve the need. The drama of cricket shouldn't depend on being able to see old Jimmy Anderson's getting angry, isn't it?
But you are not. Of course, I'm not saying that's the primary thing.
There's no interest in watching people go, but go and watch, go and watch EastEnders.
Right. Here's the thing. Of course, I'm not saying the primary interest is the expression of passion, but the fact is you are watching human beings, and that is what makes it interesting and compelling. You're watching a great battle between bat and ball, but at the same time you're watching, for example, batsmen struggle with the ability to remain composed mentally when they are hit by a bouncer.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the same way, you're watching bowlers struggle to remain composed when, in Anderson's case, a couple of catches go down. It is a drama. It's part of the human drama.
Yeah, and actually, but I agree that the human drama is a huge part of it, but you want to see it played out in the format that is cricket. Okay, so you don't want to see so a bowler confronting, walking up to a batsman and eyeballing him is kind of extraneous to it. Extraneous to the game. So actually, if a batsman is bowled a bouncer and he's absolutely terrified and he doesn't know how to play it, it's actually much more interesting to watch him then facing subsequent bowling than it is. The drama is in that, not in seeing him go and cry in a corner.
I would personally,
that's not human drama.
Draw a line if, for example, and I it's a bit unfair to keep coming back to Jimmy Anderson because, you know, lots of cricketers lose their temper, but this is the recent
example. He is a pertinent example.
He is really quite stroppy for someone who's not that young anymore. Anyway. Had he run down the track and sort of, you know, shoulder bar, you know, for me, there's obviously violence that I would draw lines to. Had he started, like, very loudly swearing. But I think going sort of eye to eye with the batsman, it's not something I find offensive. It's not something that completely offends my sense of, you know, what is and isn't cricket. Kept within those sort of limits.
But the problem is, where do you... it's incredibly difficult to draw boundaries here, and actually I think that the best ultimately is a sign of a weak cricketer, and actually the very, very best cricketers are the cricketers who don't need to, you know, intimidate, are the cricketers who are able to express themselves by playing cricket, by the way that they play cricket, and that ultimately is why we follow it as sport rather than as drama.
Yeah,
or as music,
I mean, I guess it's a separate debate, but I would agree with you the extent to which the great cricketers, you would say probably for the most part, the great cricketers are those who are able to control their emotions. Although that being said, I mean, someone like Shane Warne, I think, could be an example of someone who's
quite consistently emotional.
It's not about
being able to necessarily to control your emotions. I'm not disputing the fact of people being able to feel emotion, but it's just the fact that those should be expressed through the medium of the sport rather than through something that's essentially extraneous.
But so you are offended, for example, by the sight of a bowler eyeballing a batsman, sort of going, that is something that you would say
I mean there are subtleties in the sense that there is I'm not saying there is a hard line whereby everyone is a complete robot, and I'm not saying that there's no way that there's any kind of human communication between but I think the idea of losing one's temper and kind of taking it out on someone, which is kind of what happens in football, that when people lose their temper, they don't take it out by playing really, really well. They take it out by going and thumping someone or arguing with the referee or whatever, which is kind of what we're talking about. And that's kind of the more human drama. And all I'm saying is that actually it's much more interesting as cricket fans if we can actually see it played out through the game rather than necessarily through human temper.